Hey, we wanted to let you know about something exciting that the Lifeway Leadership Team is offering around the country for church leaders and church leadership teams. If you missed our Pipeline Conference last fall in Nashville, that means you missed out on a chance to have a full day of coaching on how to develop a leadership pipeline in your church. But you don't have to miss that, because throughout this spring, we are taking that coaching on the road. So we recently did a coaching day in Orange County, California, and then in the coming months, we'll be doing them in Dallas, Charlotte, Washington, D.C., Richmond area, and then Phoenix, Arizona. So if you go to myleadershippipeline.com/regionals, so that's myleadershippipeline.com/regionals, you can see these cities, you can sign up. These are full day events, so they run from the morning until mid to late afternoon. So it's a drivable kind of thing. You can bring a team with you. You can see more information there, myleadershippipeline.com/regionals. We would love it if you would join us in one of these cities to begin developing a leadership pipeline with your team. And then again, join us in the fall, in October, for our national conference in Nashville. We will have speakers like John Piper, Bob Russell, H.B. Charles, and others talking to us about transitions in leadership, so handing off from one leader to another. So again, go to myleadershippipeline.com to learn more, and specifically myleadershippipeline.com/regionals to sign up for a coaching day for your team.
Hey, and welcome to the 5 Leadership Questions podcast. I am your host, Barnabas Piper. In just a minute, I will be joined by my co-host, Todd Adkins, and we will have a conversation with Pastor J.D. Greer. J.D. is the pastor of the Summit Church in Raleigh-Durham, North Carolina. He has been there for several years. It is a large church. They have sites all over the Raleigh-Durham area, and then they plant churches all around North Carolina as well as other parts of the country. And we get into that. We get into what is the strategy between sites and church planting. We talk about leadership and fame, leadership and accountability, leadership in the home, work rhythms and life. So there's some really, really practical stuff, some kind of higher level ministry strategy things, church planting things, kind of the whole variety. JD is also a really fun guy to talk to, so it's an engaging conversation. He has a good sense of humor, and so we get into all that. He is also an author of at least 4 books. If you go to jdgreer.com, you can find his blog, you can find the books like Stop Asking Jesus Into Your Heart, Jesus Continued, Gospel, Gaining by Losing. That's a book about church multiplication and church planting. So those are all there. He's done some Bible study work. So he's a pretty prolific communicator of truth and very gospel-centered and gospel-focused, but in a really personable, practical way. So I think you'll very much enjoy this conversation. Again, you can go to jdgreer.com to see more there, or you can go to lifeway.com/leadership, where you will find the show notes for this with quotes and links to various books and resources as well. So here is the conversation with J.D. Greer. Enjoy. We are here today with J.D. Greer, who you heard in the intro is the pastor of the Summit Church in North Carolina. And I think it's fair to say North Carolina because they have locations everywhere in the state, and planting 1,000 churches is their goal, as you heard. And so, J.D., welcome to the 5 Leadership Questions podcast. We're excited to have you on.
Oh, yeah. Thanks so much. Yeah. The church, just to be clear, we have locations in Raleigh-Durham. That's we're a multi-site church there. And then outside of Raleigh-Durham, we plant churches. So that's where that 1,000 number of churches kicks in. Yeah.
Okay. So I normally give the guest a chance to introduce themselves, but I have a question about planting churches versus campuses versus like what is the difference between planting a campus and planting a church? And Todd could happily answer this for me, but I'm not interested in what he has to say. I'm interested in what you have to say.
Well, I guess the short, pithy answer is we try to plant campuses where we have people coming from, and we plant churches where we don't have people coming from. And what I mean by that is we pursued a multi-campus approach to reaching our city simply as an alternative to building one big, huge, gargantuan building that cost $100 million. We just, you know, knew that it would be more efficient and more effective as a church if you had multiple, you know, venues across the city where they were meeting. The line we use is stay where you are, serve where you live. Let's be the church right there in that local community. And it's been effective. We do, you know, our ecclesiology is such that we believe a local church ought to be local. And so it doesn't make sense for us to for example, in Miami or in Phoenix, Arizona, to have a campus, because people from Phoenix and Miami are not driving to come to the Summit Church, you know, in Raleigh-Durham. So
yet,
screen, we raise up a leader and send out a core team from our church, which usually consists of 30 to 40 people, and we, you know, put them in that other city. So it's kind of driven by I'd like to think our ecclesiology is what drives it. And we just say, you know, campuses are only for the Triangle area, the Raleigh-Durham area, and churches are for everywhere else. We also plant churches in Raleigh-Durham because there are certain parts of the city that we're just not, you know, not as effective at reaching or whatever. So when we don't have people come from an area of the city, that's when we raise up a leader and we send them out to plant a church in that part of the city.
That's very cool.
Gotcha.
And we both know a couple of different guys. I've sent a couple guys your all's way, actually. John McGowan would be one of those. But
thank you times 100, because he's been fantastic.
Well, yeah, he was part of the ministry that I was He came out of McLean in the gathering, and I know there's one or two other ones coming your way as well. But one of the things that I appreciate more than anything else is your all's blend of reaching your city and also sending out. So I think that's a beautiful model that marries both campuses and church planting very well.
Hmm. Yeah, it's really been streamlined. I mean, this is not obviously the place to. You know, we're not going to just expound multi-site and its virtues and its
sure
problems.
We can.
Yeah, you're, sure we can. You're getting Todd real excited right now.
You know, JD, we're given two examples as church leaders in Scripture. One is a shepherd. One is a steward. I lean a little bit more steward than shepherd. Everybody, I think, leans one direction or the other. Eric Geiger is the only person I've ever seen that really marries both really well, and he's our boss daddy, so
yeah,
we'll pay homage.
He's also an android, so
this is true.
Well, normally we don't jump straight into questions like that, but because of it's I have some friends who are pastors in Chapel Hill and the surrounding area, and so I've had conversations with them about trying to understand the planting versus the campuses, and so I wanted to get some clarity for that. Now let's rewind to the beginning of the podcast and give you a chance to actually tell people a little bit about yourself other than ecclesiology. So how you got to where you are, your family, your ministry, anything that gives our listeners a sense of who you are kind of outside of the bullet-pointed bio stuff.
Yeah, well, I'll start. My call to ministry really began with a call to the mission field. I was in a school. I was actually planning on going into law and started a Bible study on my campus that just really grew, and people were coming to faith in Christ. And I remember just one morning telling God, like, I would really, really like to do – I'd like to teach the Bible. And at the same time, God was really opening my heart to what it meant for 2.2 billion people to have never heard the name of Jesus. And so I said, God, if you'll let me go into ministry and just teach people about the gospel, I will. And I felt like the Holy Spirit said, absolutely, you know, permission granted. And so I went over to be a missionary in Southeast Asia for a couple of years. And it was two of the, in some one sense, least fruitful years of my life, because in just terms of, you know, seeing people come to faith in Christ, because it was a very fundamentalist Muslim area. And on the other hand, I felt like it was two of the greatest years of my life in terms of God just working in me and tearing down idols in my heart and tearing out some self-confidence and, you know, putting in its place faith in the gospel and the work of God in my life. And so I came back, did a PhD in Christian understanding of salvation and Muslim understanding of salvation and points of interlap between the two and where, you know, where a good bridge for the gospel was. Well, during that time that I was doing the PhD is when, God began to show me that my role in the Great Commission, and especially internationally, was going to be a pastor of a church in the United States that, among the other things that it did, really had a focus on raising up and sending out. I always tell our church that my call to the pastorate began as a call to the mission field, and the way I'm fulfilling my call to the mission field is as a pastor. And so it was located in the Triangle, has a lot of college students. And so it just, you know, I became pastor of this kind of sleepy little Baptist church, and God began to move in, and a lot of students began to come, and it just, you know, has grown, you know, over the years. And there's a lot of things that, you know, no church is about one thing only, but You know, I feel like when I what gets my blood kind of pumping is seeing leaders raised up and sent out, and whether they're going overseas to Muslim areas or whether they're going to Denver, Colorado to plant a church. It's something that God has really written in the DNA of who we are. Family, I have a wife and four children. We've been married since right before I became pastor of this church. So it's a wonderful. She is in many ways, in some ways, the opposite of me in a good way. She just is very. She loves just going deep with people locally, and so it's just been it's a wonderful part of my ministry and life.
So she is the she's the shepherd to your
steward.
She's texting
him right now.
That's right.
Yeah, you know, it shows you my technology. I'm busily looking at this computer, thinking, how do you turn that off?
It's all right. It's helps.
Ambiance.
Yeah,
that's how we roll. That's how people know we're authentic.
We've done podcasts with people where there's like sirens in the background and stuff. So the chiming of that it's going to make everybody look at their own phones while they listen. They're like, it's me.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, that's leads us into our first questions. Other than Danny Franks, who are you currently learning from?
yeah. That's how do you know Danny?
Oh, who doesn't know Danny?
That's a really good point.
He's actually been on. He's actually been on the podcast before. He did. He did one with us that was a kind of a special one on guest services.
Okay. Yeah.
And he did a bunch of training with Ministry Grid, some video training when we launched that, and so he's been sort of an asset and an advocate and a friend of what we do at Lifeway Leadership for a while, for better and worse.
Mostly, we just like him because he's fun, so we continue to
we find reasons to hang out.
Yeah, it's like hanging out with Statler and Waldorf all the time.
He is like been with me for 15 years, and that's the value. I know we'll probably get to this later in the podcast, but the value of just doing life with people and spending a long ministry with people that you get to go really deep with, that's one of the most underestimated and rewarding things that I feel like it contributes to my quality of life as a leader. Do awesome things with awesome people is kind of just a way that I would describe, like, what should you do, you know, when you look at the future.
That's a good ministry model.
Awesome things with awesome people. Okay, so, sorry, I started that. So who are you currently learning from?
Yeah, you know, so I feel like I've definitely got a peer level of people that are other ministry leaders that I'm learning from, and it'd be guys like, guys that have churches similar to ours. Joby Martin down in Florida is one. Village Church is pretty close to us. You know, Chandler and Patterson and those guys out there. And Matt Carter at Austin Stone, those guys are definitely there. I've got being a Southern Baptist, I have a lot of mentors in my life from that world. Danny Aiken is one that, you know, speaks in quite regularly into my life. And those are great. There are a couple of current writing leaders that have been pretty influential in just shaping our church recently. One of them is Andy Stanley. Some of his stuff and just being able to get to know him. I know that there's plenty of things that he does and ways that he pursues things. It wouldn't be identical to the way that we do them, but I just feel like God has given him a gift, you know, for knowing how to lead people and how to inspire vision. And so I'm definitely learning from him right now in that realm. Paul Tripp is another one that just the way that he kind of understands what a leader's soul looks like. I recently talked to him and just, you know, with all these, let's just call them mega church pastors that have gone into, you know, kind of fallen away, and I won't name names, but I mean, it's just been like a dozen of them in the last, you know, 3 or 4 years. I just asked them, I'm like, why, you know, what is it about these? What is the common denominator? And my first guess was, you know, was it a lack of community? Was it just, and he said, no, he said, you look at them, they had most of them, not all of them, but most of them had plenty of people around them. He said, what it was, they didn't have equality in community. It was definitely there was them and there was everybody underneath them. And so it's really, you know, kind of made us, he's spoken into my life and how have I structured my peer community around me. And that's kind of the last thing I want to get to is, you know, Ecclesiastes says better is a friend nearby than a brother far away. And I found that some of the most life-giving influential things are people that I'm just very close to here. And they may not do the same kind of ministry I do, but they love Jesus and walk with him. And they're able to pick out, you know, things that are happening in my relationship with my wife. And they're like, you know, this just seems off, you know, like the way that you're responding to her here. And so, you know, having friends, I chose last couple of years ago to move into a neighborhood with some people basically from our church that I was really close to. And we all live, you know, just a few houses away from each other. And we just are part of the community and a part of life. And so Paul Tripp has been influential in kind of helping shape that. And it's very life giving. And so those other, you know, friends are part of my life as well.
Do you think that kind of community that you're describing, especially, you know, the kind where somebody just knows you well enough to be able to take a look and go, that doesn't seem like you, that seems off, whether it's whether it's marriage, whether it's something in your character, or just the mood you're in. Is that harder as a pastor, as a leader, or is it just sort of hard because we're human?
Well, I mean, both. I think one compounds the other. It's hard because we're human. I mean, we all like, I think, just because of our simple nature to be isolated. But Proverbs 18, an isolated man seeks his own desire and rages against all sound judgment. It's I fight that as just a man, an American man growing up. I want to be more independent. I find that a lot of times friendships are sometimes more messy than they are convenient. And it's just you end up taking on liability. And so there's that as a center. But as a pastor, there's also just you like to be a leader that's unchallenged.
Yeah.
And I like to be able just to sit from my office and say, this is what we're going to do and all that thing. But it's just it's bad leadership. And it's also bad for my soul. You know, we've set up our elder team in our church that, you know, I lose votes sometimes on our elder team. And it always kind of frustrates me when it happens. But it's one of the healthiest things, I think, and because I need that kind of, I don't need to be the Lord, you know, small L of this, of this community. I need to be a normal guy. I need to have people who are not that impressed with me.
Yeah. I remember sitting in a room with, Alistair Begg was presenting to a bunch of pastors, and he just said something along the lines of, it is a very dangerous thing to get to a place where nobody on your team can tell you no.
Yeah. And here's the trajectory. I read this article. It was talking about Hollywood celebrities, which, you know, hopefully are not, you know, super alike mega church pastors, but he was just talking about how what happens is everybody around you starts to have a vested interest in your success. And so nobody wants to speak negatively to you because they're part of the gravy train. So as our church gets big, all these other people are benefited. And so I've got to have people who don't have that vested interest, who are not just telling me things that I want to hear and want me to, you know, want to stay on my good side so that I can, you know, continue to reward them and bring them along with me. You just need people that are just don't have a vested interest in terms of their own success and are able to speak real truth into my life and call out indwelling sin. To go back to Paul Tripp for a minute, he said the two things that these guys who fell all seem to have in common is a lack of real authentic community. Community was there, but that kind of peer or other people speaking into their life kind of community. And he said the other one was none of them seemed to take seriously the doctrine of indwelling sin, that even after you get saved and after you become successful in ministry, there's still in your flesh is no good thing, and left to its own devices will always, every time, take you to a destructive place.
Yeah, it's interesting thinking about that idea of, you know, the gravy train and people who don't want to challenge you, because I think that is compounded by the spiritual aspect of things, because oftentimes senior pastors, especially the larger the ministry is, are kind of viewed as spiritually next level. And so challenging them feels like you're challenging somebody who's a bit closer to God. Now, those of us who grew up around pastors know that's patently false. But I think that's still the tendency of people. So not only is there the leadership aspect and the gravy train aspect, but there's this sort of spiritual complication of, ooh, I don't want to challenge somebody who might know God's will better than I do, or something like that.
Sadly, Barnabas, we like that. We kind of like that feeling of, as pastors, whatever is the size of our church, I like being kind of looked at as, man, you know, my head's a little bit higher than everybody else. Yeah. And that's sinful flesh, and man, left, you know, be cautious, lest being lifted up with pride, we fall into the condemnation of the devil. And that's what the devil was. He just wanted to be a little bit higher than everybody else.
So, you know, you're talking about being known, and the more you're, you know, the more you're, the more success you have, the more known you are. And that could be just your church. It could be your city. It could be, you know, nationally. What are some of those practical things? And you've mentioned a few of them, but how do I move from being, you know, capital K known to being, you know, where somebody actually knows me in my community and can call those things out?
Well, the place I would start is, you know, you ever heard in parenting, there's no such thing as a difference between quality time and quantity time. You got to have quantity to have quality. Well, in the same way, I feel like there's a gravitational pull as our church gets bigger for me to spend more time doing the bigger things, and at the expense of my just ministry in my local community. The more that I invest, whether it's with leaders here, church, you know, people here, Bible studies I'm involved with in my neighborhood. You know, I have a Bible study right now I lead at the gym that I work out at. And I'm just going to go ahead and tell you, those guys, when we meet for Bible study, are not impressed with me at all, because they don't know me as JD, the pastor of the large church. They know me as JD, the guy who can barely front squat 185, you know, 350. So that's healthy. And it's also, this is what I have a hard time convincing, or maybe I'll just say it's taken me a long time to learn it. That kind of community is God designed, and it's life-giving, because it is according to the design of God. God just didn't create us to live off of fame. My wife, I love the way she says it. And it's a little bit what I said at the beginning, and then in some ways she's got kind of opposite proclivities to me. She says, fame is always making yourself accessible to a bunch of people you don't really care about at the expense of those that you do. And as I've looked at kind of, you know, just trying to manage, like, what is it like to have a church where people know who you are, and whether you're writing books or doing podcasts or whatever, you know, those kind of relationships are just not as life-giving as people that you are in community with, who know you and go deep with you and are peers and not subjects.
Yeah, that definition of fame sounds a lot like social media too. That hit a little close to home. So we're going to move on to our next question. Our second question is, what is the main point of emphasis for your leadership right now, either for the team, the leadership team there at Summit Church, or for yourself personally growing as a leader?
Well, yeah, to go back to, I mentioned Andy Stanley a minute ago. I mean, one of the things he talks about is learning to listen deeply in your organization. And that's a main point of leadership for us right now, is not isolating ourselves so that we're in an echo chamber. Because as a ministry succeeds, it ends up being what happens, is your success justifies who you are. And so we've been really trying to, what are ways that we can give and receive godly feedback? How connected are we to normal congregation members? I just finished a book when I took our staff through parts of it, Creativity Inc., Ed Catmull. It's not a Christian book.
It's such a good book.
Oh, yeah. And he's the leader of Pixar, or the founder of Pixar. But he talks about that, about you know, how to, as Pixar has kind of blown up and succeeded, how you start laying in the traps that cause really good organizations to lose their bearings and collapse. And so we've been going through that. And I'd say it's a big point of emphasis. The other one that comes is just the continual kind of urge to give ourselves to raising up leaders instead of just building our organization large. Jim Collins, in another book, who again is not necessarily a Christian book, but Jim Collins says that, you know, you've got leaders that are basically a genius with 1,000 helpers, and then leaders that are devoted to raising up better leaders around them. And I know that the greatest long-term effect we will have is not the amount of people we gather to come to the Summit Church on the weekend, but the amount of leaders that we raise up to pastor churches that one day hopefully will be more fruitful and more effective than the Summit Church is. So those would be the two big things that are on my leadership docket for the year of continuing to lead the Summit Church team in.
So leadership development is something that this team at Lifeway, I mean, we kind of exist to help churches with that. And so that emphasis you described on developing leaders who can go pastor other churches, things like that. What are some of the things that the Summit Church has in place to raise those leaders up? Now we have talked, like we mentioned earlier, to Danny about really starting at the ground level with volunteers and beginning to develop those people. But kind of above that or beyond that, outside of that, what are some of the other things that your church does?
Well, some of it is just your general philosophy. I mean, there's a difference in recruiting volunteers and raising up leaders. Recruiting volunteers is, you know, it's my idea. I'm responsible for it, and I need you to help me out with it. Raising up leaders is a mentality that says, you know, yeah, I've been tasked with keeping the mission aligned and that we're going in a direction, but I need you to discover the spiritual gifts within you and let's figure out where God has gifted you and how you're supposed to be in the kingdom, and let me begin to come behind you and help you discover that. There's three categories of ministry we use at the Summit Church, and every one of our pastoral leaders is responsible for fostering all three of these kinds. We call them own, catalyze, and bless. Own is a ministry that we, the church, take responsibility for. We fund it. We staff it. We recruit volunteers for it. Those would be a lot of your traditional church ministries. On the other end of the spectrum is what we would call bless, and that's like a person comes up with a ministry idea. Hey, pastor, I want to, give a number two pencil to every public school teacher in the Triangle area that, that when you erase things, it'll play There's Power in the, blood or something like that. And you're like, that sounds like a great idea. Why don't you do that? And we'll pray about it. And you come back in 2 years and tell me how it worked. That's, bless. In the middle is this category that we call catalyze, where it's not ministries that we are owning, but nor are we simply blessing them. We're saying to somebody that we see is gifted, we're saying, how can we come behind your ministry idea and get on your team and let you lead us into the community and let you, begin to do these things? And some of the most fruitful ministries in our church started that way. Didn't start with me coming up with an initiative or another pastor coming up with an initiative. They started with saying that we, the pastors, are supposed to be in some ways the servants of the ministry that is given to the church. And we're there to serve their ministries, not just they ours. So it's a mentality. It's a mentality shift that kind of turns things on its head. Because I feel like the natural tendency is for us to, I've got things I want to see succeed and I need the people to help me do it. Whereas, leaders kind of turns that upside down and focuses the other way.
So one of the other things that, Collins is known for is having stop doing lists.
Yeah.
So how do you marry those two things? Like how do you keep how do you keep from all these new ministries?
How do you keep from getting sort of program bloated, so to speak?
Yeah. And that's a good question. And that's part of the art of it. I think my role as a pastor is both in front of and behind the congregation. And I don't have a great analogy for this. Maybe one day I'll come up with one, but it's almost like I want to jump out in the front and kind of help people understand where we should be going and kind of inspire ideas, paint a picture of what I believe and the other leaders believe God has for the future. And then I want to get behind the other leaders in the church and say, how are we going to get there? And then my role, is think of it like a guy sitting on a stagecoach, is then to keep the stallions going the same direction. And sometimes that means fighting against mission drift and nixing programs. But that's not the same as taking away the initiative from the leaders themselves.
Gotcha.
I'll give you an example. Our church planting director is a guy that's just, man, he's a great leader. He comes up with great initiatives and ideas. I don't sit down with him and say, let me tell you what domestic church planting at the Summit Church needs to look like in the next 5 years. He knows that better than I do. What I do is, I'll meet with him and say, man, here are the values that I feel like really ought to shape our church, and here's kind of where I would like to see us go. How are we going to get there? And then I step out of the way and let him start to show the initiative and to lead. And then I'll step back in occasionally and say, hey, I think we need to course correct just a little bit this direction. And you know, so I don't know if that makes sense kind of in how we're balancing the two, but I think both sides of the equation have to be there, because on one side, if you don't balance it, you'll go to mission drift. And on the other side, you'll end up becoming a place with a bunch of volunteers and no leaders.
Okay. So I'm going to shift completely into a new line of questioning, and that is, what are two or three things that you absolutely must do daily, and then what benefit do they have for your life and leadership? And reading the Bible is not one of those things.
Oh,
spiritual disciplines.
Well,
don't
I mean,
it's that
we assume it's one of those things, and so yes, you have to list the other things.
Well, you know, I realize that a question like that, a lot of it is. It really does kind of correspond to your personality. And I've found that my rest rhythms are different than some other pastors. And so I just want to give that kind of as a word of caution. Just because something works for me doesn't mean that that's the way it ought to be for everybody. I've always found that I work best when I reserve, I clear everything out of my morning except for the Word of God and prayer and kind of just time alone with God, writing sermons and writing, whether it's blogs or whatever. I don't take any appointments until noon. And so the 4 days a week that I work, Monday through Thursday, not counting the weekend, obviously, the 4 days that, you know, I have every day till noon that is just time with, like I said, you know, devoted to study and preparation and leadership. And that to me is kind of essential in continuing to preach with quality and conviction and passion. And I realized that the majority of the value that I add to our church occurs within 1 hour on the weekend, you know, in terms of the sermon. So I know that I just don't want to ever take away from that. And that's a time I then kind of block off. My afternoons are going to be devoted to staff development and meeting with staff or meeting with, you know, congregation members or whatever. Which it leads me to a kind of another thing with this is rhythm. For me, rhythm really works. I can handle an extraordinary load of things if there's a daily rhythm that I turn everything off. I mean, with the church at about 6:15, and I'm like, you know, I'm not going to give my night to thinking more about this or doing that. I mean, occasionally at a church, you got to have a meeting at night, but for the most part, that's just time with my kids and relaxing with my wife, and we're doing things we, you know, enjoy, whether it's reading or watching something on TV or playing games as a family or, you know, whatever. You know, that I found that when I try to cheat that and I try to, like, well, let me just work on the sermon for an hour at night, I found that all I do is mess up the rhythm for the rest of the week and the times where I really could be having, you know, good time in the morning, I've cheated myself by doing it at night. So rhythm is a big one of those as well. So those would be a couple things.
How did you I don't know if train is the right word. How did you set expectations with your team to leave you alone both in the morning and after 6:15?
Yeah, that was a lot. Now, you know, being in 15 years, it's pretty much just taken for granted. I think the first year I was a pastor, I just disappointed a lot of people. And I was just like, look, unless you're on fire, like don't.
Like, you know, literally on fire.
Literally, I'll walk in here and you have burst into flames. At that point, I'll get up from my death. But obviously, you know, you guys, you can abuse that. I mean, we don't want to be so inflexible that you don't respond to genuine opportunities. But, you know, I just told people, you know, I'm sorry. This is what I've got to focus on right now. And that's something I can do this afternoon. So as long as you don't abuse it, I think it's a healthy practice to have. It's kind of like Stephen Covey's principle, the big rocks.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, you got to put those in first and know how you contribute best to the kingdom. Another great book, not a Christian book, 4-Hour Work Week. Is definitely not a Christian book, but in there, the guy talks about, you know, he says, whatever it is that would bring most value to whatever you're leading, make sure it's done by 10 o'clock in the morning. And then if you end up squandering the rest of the day, at least you've moved, you know, the organization. And that's kind of what I'm doing, is saying what the value that I add that really moves the church forward is going to be done by noon. And then the rest of the time, you know, I can not have as much where I get to the end of the week and say, well, what happened this week?
Yeah.
If I'm a terrible preacher, but I'm the greatest, you know, counselor and administrator, People may be happy sometimes, but the church is not going to be, you know, thriving. On the flip side, if I'm a, you know, if I deliver every weekend, but, you know, there are other things that are not as good, I know that, you know, I'm going to be moving the church forward and I'm growing it spiritually and even, you know, numerically. And so I'm just going to make sure the best part of my week goes into the thing that I can add the most value through.
Yeah, I think that's, as for our work week, that's Tim Ferriss, right? Is that the author's name?
Yeah, correct.
And then, but just one of the things that caught my attention from what you just described is, I mean, there's a productivity principle, and that is that anybody who's doing any sort of thoughtful or creative work, it has to be done in blocks of time.
Oh, totally.
So if you started taking appointments in the morning and you're like, oh, I've got an hour and a half for study here and an hour for writing there, that's fragmented thought. But if you can take 4, 5, 6 hours straight, I don't know how early you get up, and block it out, that is where the most productive creative thought, writing, strategy, anything like that is done. It has to be done in chunks of time, which is something where, you know, the danger of interruptions and protecting against them is, I mean, that's why that's so essential.
Well, and could I give a complimentary idea? Because I totally agree with that. But let me something on the other side. I've also found, again, I want to make a caveat. Maybe this is just more personality. I've found that 10 to 12 hour blocks of times become very unproductive. You know, like that's too long.
Oh,
if I had 16 hours to use on a sermon, it's better to do four hour blocks,
yeah,
or even
totally.
5, 3 hour blocks, because every day, I've heard that it takes your mind about 4 hours to reset. So if you leave something alone for 4 hours, you come back to it and you're like, man, what was I thinking there? What, you know, there was a natural, you know, kind of connection I made that nobody else will be able to follow my train of thought. And you won't see it if you spend all your time there at the moment and don't take, you know, these frequent kind of breaks.
Yeah. And I've found the same thing in writing books, is that I do best if I go, you know, 8 to 12 or 8 to 1. As opposed to trying to carve out a whole day and write, you know, like a 9 to 5 shift, because usually the second half of that is, I end up having to erase anything I wrote then anyway, because it ends up just being kind of garbage.
That's right. Yeah, I always call him Evening JD. Evening JD, when he comes in, all he does when he writes or prepares is he just messes up Morning JD. Morning JD is awesome. He's quick and he's witty and he's thoughtful, and Night JD is just dull and banal. And if he tries to work, he just messes up Morning JD. So the best thing Evening JD can do with Morning JD is enjoy his family, read a book, watch a show on TV, and go to bed on the right time.
Which you just led into our fourth question just about perfectly, because it is, what does leadership in your home look like? And you mentioned, you know, your wife, your four children, carving out time in the evenings for them, protecting that. But what else? What does leadership in your home look like kind of across the board?
Well, really dictatorial. you know, I feel like this is the easiest place to kind of slack on that ends up costing the most in the long run. I mean, you show up, meet a person who's walking with God, and then their family life is strong, and they're able to withstand so much in terms of, you know, opposition at work or problems in their career. But when those things are kind of, you know, corroding, it ends up affecting everything. And so to go back to the big rocks principle, my wife and I sit down, and neither of us are awesome planners, so let me emphasize that, but we sit down every 3 or 4 months and we plan out a family calendar, and it includes, like, you know, what nights, you know, we're going to be home and family activities we're doing. We guard that time. I have an assistant, so she's part of that meeting, and I set, you know, whether it's dates with my children or, you know, family things we're doing. We just, you know, we found that if you're not intentional in that, it's just like everything else. You kind of wake up a year later and you're like, well, what happened to that time? I didn't mean to, you know, spend so little time on that. We know that I have to show a lot of intentionality in the church. And what I found was that I wasn't showing that same intentionality with my family. And you know, that basically I would, if I led my church the way I led my family, then they would fire me. And so it was just putting some thought into it and guarding, you know, perimeters. We, you know, I know that I mentioned 6:15, that's the time I turn things off, and it's just, I mean, that's like game time, you know, between there and 8:30 when my kids are, you know, headed to bed is time that just, you know, games, conversations, being outside together. you know, all those sort of things. So it's got to be disciplined, and it's got to be a big rock.
How do you this is not written in any of our questions, but just as a pastor of a very large church, it would be very easy to let the schedule of your life kind of be dictated by the needs of the church. So how do you carve out like vacation time and blocks of time with your family that are, you know, that are greater than 2 hours in an evening? So time to get away, just a day off, whatever those things are, to spend even more focused and intentional time.
Yeah. Well, if I could start spiritual for a minute.
That's allowed.
Okay. All right. Well, just real quick. Then I'll get, but, you know, you take the principle of the Sabbath in the Old Testament, you had a day that they were supposed to set aside where they weren't going to do anything. And God explained to them in Deuteronomy that one of the reasons for that is because he didn't want them getting to the place of success and looking back and saying, look at all that I accomplished. So he had them do less than they could have done, you know, to be technical, 1/7 less than they could have done, so that when they got there to that place of success, they would give glory to God. Psalm 127 hits that same principle, but from a different angle. Psalm 127 talks about, you know, unless the Lord builds a city, those who labor in vain. Then it goes on to talk about, like, in vain does the watchman stay up late and does the farmer get up early. But God gives to his beloved sleep. Well, the dilemma with sleep is, you know, if I'm sleeping, who's guarding the city? And if I'm, you know, sleeping in the early morning hours, then who's getting up and plowing the crops? And the answer from the psalm is God is. God is the one who's ultimately building the city. And what I've got to do is learn to do the role that God has given me, and then trust that God is going to take care of the rest. It's the same principle in tithing. You don't give, you know, generously. You don't give God your first fruits because you've got excess money sitting around your bank account, can't figure out what to do with it. You give, you know, sometimes when you feel like you can't afford it, because God's going to take that lesser amount that you bring to the table, whether we're talking about time or money, and God's going to multiply it because you honored him first with it. So I've found that it's actually insulting to God for me to take time away from sleep, you know, Psalm 127, to take time away from rest. You know, that's the Sabbath principle. What I need to do is I need to be able to have the faith in God just to turn things off and say, yes, somebody needs to be watching the city, and that's going to have to be God. Somebody's going to need to be up early plowing the crops, but God designed me to lay down every single night for 7.5 hours and just declare in faith, I'm not God, which is why I sleep, and he's going to be the one building the city. And so, you know, bringing that kind of perspective of faith into my schedule means that there are things that God expects for me to guard with my, you know, guard your life, your doctrine, and then guard this. And those things are, you know, time for refreshment, rest, walk with God, time with my family. You know, and so we unashamedly put those in the schedule and say everything else that the church needs is going to come now fit into this, this time schedule. I don't know if this is making sense, but the same way I do my budget with, you know, after I give God the first fruits, then I look at the other, whatever I have left, whether that's 80%, 90%, I look at it and say, how am I going to fit in all the rest of the bills into this? But God got the first. And so part of God getting the first is making sure that he and my family and those parts, you know, get the right time out of my schedule. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And I think that's a really helpful principle. And that's, you know, I just wanted, for leaders who feel kind of taxed and maxed out in a lot of ways, it's helpful to hear somebody who could easily be that talk about how to make time to Sabbath, if nothing else. I mean, just make time for vacation, make time for family, make time to sleep. And I think the way you described it gives it's the mindset behind it, not just the discipline of scheduling.
Yeah, I'll tell you one quick thing. We were talking about 4-hour work week a minute ago. The author there talked about how, you know, these virtual assistants you can hire from India. I don't have one, but he said that he hired one because he found himself worrying about his business, like at nighttime. So he actually hired an assistant, and one of her assignments was to start worrying at 5 o'clock his time until 7 o'clock the next morning. And he said he would get a letter from her in the morning, says, "Hello, Mr. So-and-so. Just want you to know I spent last night while you were asleep worrying about X, Y, and Z, so you didn't have to." And it was just kind of like a joke, but I thought, man, that's perfect, because what I do is at night I say, okay, God, I've worried about this particular aspect and tried to fix it in the church until 6:15. And then as of now, I got to go off the clock and I need you to worry about this until the morning when I'll pick it back up. And obviously when I pick it back up, I'm still doing that with faith, but I can turn my mind off because the Lord is the one building the city. And so me, the watchman, doesn't have to stay up all night worrying about things that ultimately belong to God now.
Well, I mean, you know, it sounds like that's one of the things you've probably learned over the course of time. So looking back, our fifth question is this: what would you tell your 20-year-old self about preparing to lead?
Yeah, you know, just even thinking back through our conversation, you know, I would make sure to tell him, like, the key to – I realize we're not trying to be happy in life, but one of the keys to quality of life is do awesome things with awesome people. Choose that team carefully. You make sure that you surround yourself with people that are people of character and that will love you enough to speak into your life. And if you have the luxury of doing it, make it really people that you enjoy. I'd rather do a mediocre task with awesome people than I would, you know, awesome things with mediocre people. If I were only thinking for quality of life. And so, you know, I'd look back and say, by God's grace, you know, I have that opportunity now. I have people like Danny Franks and other people who are just my best friends in the whole world that I get to come to work with every day. And that not only contributes to my enjoyment of life, it contributes to the quality of what I do. Another one I would tell myself is to be patient, that God has seasons in our lives. I've spent my entire life always wishing I could be in the next season. And I've just ended up, you know, like missing some of the things that God wanted to do. I think a lot of times of David, King David in the Bible, that, you know, here God calls, anoints him as king. And then, you know, if you look at it, he doesn't run off to the palace to try on robes. He goes back to the pasture to shepherd sheep again for what scholars think is probably 7 or 8 years. And I think, how hard would that be to feel like you're called to be king, know you're called to be king, and then be back in the pasture, you know, watching sheep? But it was there that he learned to fight the lion and the bear and ultimately the courage that would make him a hero in Israel fighting Goliath. It was there that he probably wrote Psalm 23. Some of the best things that God does in our lives is in the pasture times. I always, in our church, I refer to them as the white spaces in our lives. You know, our Bibles are filled with text, but then occasionally you'll have a white space that represents a long amount of time. And we know how to exegete text. We don't know how to exegete white spaces in our lives. And every pastor is going to have these white spaces. And instead of rushing through it to the next one, realize that God may be doing some of his best work in that white space in your life. And so I would just tell myself, be slow and trust that when it's time for you to fight Goliath and when it's time for you to lead Israel, he's going to bring that. He's going to bring that to you, and you're not going to have to force it. The last thing I'd mention is just learning to serve. And I know that sounds slow cliche, but I feel like the tendency of the pastor is to want to lead and get large and all those kinds of things. But Tom Eliff, the former president of the International Mission Board, he pointed out to me one time, he said, you know, every single leader in the Bible had a time, usually an uninvited time, where they spent, you know, had to serve when they thought they should be leading. He said, even the apostles, we love to talk about how the apostles in Acts 6 devoted themselves to prayer and the word and stopped ministering to widows' tables. He said, but the very fact that they had to, you know, have that brought to their attention, what does that mean that the apostles were doing for 5 chapters in Acts? They were serving tables. I mean, here's the guys who are the chief witnesses of the resurrection. And for the first 5 chapters of Acts, their schedule is consumed with bringing food to widows' tables. Now, we know that Acts 6 needs to happen. You know, the best way they can serve is devoting themselves to prayer and the ministry of the word. But there's an attitude they had of servanthood that, you know, led them to serve widows at their tables that they had to be told to stop doing.
Yeah, they weren't looking to outsource right off the bat.
Right. And so I would just tell them, like, serve, glory in serving, because more pastors, I mean, we know this, like, right now my heart is just crushed with all of these pastors. It just seems like in the last 3 years, it's like every other week I turn on the, you don't turn on the internet, you know what I mean? I'll check the internet, somebody else. And I'm just like, it's they've gotten away, I think, in large part from that, those first 5 chapters of Acts, and they've jumped into the 6th chapter without going through the first 5.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's a good word. All right. We have one more bonus question. quite possibly could be our most important question.
It's definitely the one that the masses are clamoring.
Inquiring minds want to know, who is fake J.D. Greer?
The moment you started this question, I thought you were going to ask about me. Officially, I don't know.
Okay,
I think
that's fair.
To answer, I'm pretty sure I know.
Is that fake J.D. Greer texting you and saying you better not answer this?
Yeah, I think that's
totally
it. But yep, absolutely. What's even worse about this is we couldn't get the Skype working on my computer, so I'm actually on my assistant's computer, and so it's everybody texting her, and so I'm having to read all these things that are coming into her. So,
it's all about you.
Right, exactly. Right.
Can I get a meeting with JD at 10 o'clock tomorrow morning?
No.
Well, JD, thanks so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure. It's been a lot of fun. And I think our listeners will find this beneficial and helpful. I know I have. So thanks for taking the time and jumping on the podcast with us.
Man, my pleasure. I appreciate what you guys are doing.